And I'm going to begin. Good morning, my name is Chaim Angel. I'm the rabbi at Congregation Sherith Israel of New York on the Upper West Side, the first Jewish congregation in all of North America, founded in 1654. I'm here more because I teach Tanakh in this yeshiva. So the combination of the two is always fun to try to talk about different themes that affect humanity. And I was very excited actually by this theme of the Yom Iyun, love and hate in Tanakh. I think it's one of the best ones that they've chosen thus far. It happens that I'm a very optimistic, hope-filled romantic, and therefore I'm focusing entirely on the love side of the equation. Those of you who are hoping for some good, tough hate are going to have to go to another room a different time. But in the meantime, what I was interested in was love in Sefer Shmuel. After all, we're dealing with some of the most exciting characters, the most three-dimensional characters in all of Tanakh. And can you hear me all the way back there? I will try my bestest. They offered me a mic, but apparently the mic is metaphorical. And so we're going to go in that particular direction. I will try to yell, but I have a soft voice. David and Shaul and Yonatan and Michal have all kinds of interesting relationships in Sefer Shmuel. And of course, as contemporary readers as well as ancient readers, we're fascinated by these interlocking human relationships. It happens that David is viewed as one of the most passionate characters in all of Tanakh, rightly so. But here's an important bit of data that's going to affect how we learn Sefer Shmuel on this particular topic. When it talks about Shaul and his children, Yonatan and Michal, and their relationship with David, all kinds of emotions are expressed. The text, the characters, everybody's explaining Shaul loved David, Yonatan loved David, Michal loved David. Here's what it never does. It never tells us David loved them. Or in fact, it doesn't tell very much about David's emotions towards them at all. And that's very curious, because you read Tehillim or you read other parts of Sefer Shmuel and you feel David is just about as passionate and emotion-expressive individual as they go. And yet, when it comes to his relationships with his predecessor and also father-in-law Shaul, as well as his best friend Yonatan and his wife Michal, there's really very little expressed in that regard. And that's going to lead to certain ambiguities, which are incredibly important, because after all, these are people, and people love, and in other shiurim today, you may hear more about hate, but at least today we're going to focus on the love part. But they also are political figures. And when they are political figures, that means that every last drop of their love and every word that they say and don't say is on the internet the next minute. And even in the days before the internet, these people definitely felt this way. You know, they knew that internet was coming, and they knew that anything that they say or don't say is public, and everybody is scrutinizing every word. It's one of the irritants of being a public figure. Sometimes it's a catastrophe of being a public figure, but it's simply the reality. And so in the narratives that we're going to be looking at, we're going to see the back and forth of, first we're going to deal with Shaul and David, and then we'll work on Yonatan and David, and eventually we'll work our way around to Michal and David and look at different themes that we have. Here's an important statistic also just about love in Tanakh in general. There's somebody, a scholar named Susan Ackerman, published an article just 10 years ago in 2002, and she argued that never, this is an important thing because it's certainly going to be relevant for our purposes, never in Tanakh outside of Shir HaShirim, where the man and woman actually express mutual love, but in no other relationship in all of Tanakh does it say that A loved B and B loved A. It's always one way expressed. And we can even be more specific than that. We know that sometimes husbands are said to love their wives, but you never hear about a wife loving her husband. That doesn't mean that wives didn't love their husbands. I kind of hope that they did. But it's simply not mentioned that way. Likewise, we find that parents love their children, but we don't hear about the children loving their parents back. It doesn't mean that they didn't. It just means that it's not expressed that way. Once you have all of that data in front of you, you realize that something is going on. And Susan Ackerman argues very cogently, it's not because only one side in a relationship is allowed to love at a time. No. It's just that the more dominant figure, at least biblically speaking, in every relationship is the one who is said to love. So it'll say that Rivka is the parent, loves Yaakov. It'll say Yitzchak is a parent, loves Esav. It'll say that Yitzchak as a husband loves Rivka because they were viewed as the more dominant figures. And therefore, since Shaul and Yonatan and Michal are all the dominant players in the relationship with David, at least at the beginning, Shaul is king, Michal at least starts off with the greater power because she grants legitimacy to David, it's not all that surprising that it might say that these characters love David, and it doesn't say that David loved them back, because never do you have two people where it says that they love each other in that way. Okay, so that's an important bit of data that's going to become relevant. And there's also a problem with the word ahava, or lehov in Tanakh. Ahava refers to what you and I think of as good old romantic, passionate love, interpersonal love. And that's what we're talking about today, right? But it also includes, and this is going to be very relevant, political alliances. If two people are allies, if two kings are allies, it could say that they love each other. Now, it might be that they truly shower affection on one another. It could be. But it also could be that they simply have a treaty not to attack each other or to help each other in the case of war against either one. And the term ahava is used there too. Since we're dealing with political figures, and since a marriage between David and Michal is not just, oh, how sweet, what a nice romance, but rather, okay, David knows he's going to be the next king and he's marrying the king's current king's daughter, there's obviously that political alliance side of the equation on top of whatever personal love they may have one for the other. And that's incredibly relevant when dealing with all of these ambiguities. So you ready? Everybody got your source sheets? Let's start with Shaul. Shaul, as we know, poor fellow, I have a great deal of love and sympathy for him, and I mean it in the interpersonal rather than the alliance way. I have a great deal of sympathy for him. When his whole emotional state collapses after he's rejected from the monarchy, he has this ruach ra'ah, and suddenly he needs a music player, a lyre or a harp, whatever type of instrument we're talking about. And David is chosen. Funny enough, another biblical coincidence. Not only is David a fabulous military man, but he exactly has the right musical ability that cures, or at least temporarily relieves, I guess is better, Shaul's ruach ra'ah. Here we go in source number one. Vayavo David el Shaul, vayamod lefanav, vayehaveu me'od, vayilo nosek helim. Shaul loved David very much. The very first encounter that we see between Shaul and David, we find that David is able to play the instrument just so. Shaul feels so relieved, and obviously he has a great deal of love and affection towards David as soon as they meet, which is great. Now, how does David feel towards Shaul in this picture? I haven't a clue, and neither do you. Right? We're not told a thing about how David responds to the fact that he's helping the king. And not only is he helping the king, don't forget, David knows that David is going to be the next king. Shaul doesn't know that yet, although he sure will figure that out with time. But at the moment, David is just this nice shepherd boy who happens to have a musical gift. Later on, we'll find out that he has great military talents, and later on, Shaul will realize the writing on the wall that David is in fact the successor that Shmuel had done. Sefer Shmuel never talks about David's love towards Shaul back. The closest that we have is after Shaul is already throwing his spears, chasing him around the country with the army and all of that, David finally has another good biblical coincidence happen to him, which is he and his 400 merry men are hiding in a cave. And Shaul needs to relieve himself, so for privacy he ducks into the nearest cave. Funny enough, the very one where David and all of his merry men are. And of course the guards, you know, it's comical, or standing outside feeling like they're really defending their king, and in the meantime there's 401 enemies right there who could chop Shaul's head off. And indeed, that's what the 400 merry men say. Wait, hey, look, David, this is a biblical coincidence, and we're in the Bible. We can do something about this. Let's kill him. And David grabs his sword, makes his move, and then, well, we know what happens. He doesn't chop his head off, but rather cuts off a corner of his garment and uses that later on as a proof of purchase. Look, Shaul, see this thing? How do you think I got it? I had a sword, I cut a corner of your garment off, I could have gotten your head instead. But I want to prove to you and to all of the troops how loyal I am to you. And it's a very emotional response that David gives to Shaul in source number two. Hineha yom hazeh ra'ui necha. You saw with your own eyes, O king. Et asher netanecha Hashem hayom biyadi b'me'ara. You see with your own eyes that God has given me you into my hands. I could have killed you. Ve'amar l'haragacha. David told his soldiers and then likewise tells Shaul, I didn't kill you because you're God's anointed, you're God's chosen one. If you want to talk about incredible moments in the history of piety, this is about as good as you get. David has every right to kill Shaul as a rodeh. He's a pursuer, and an illegitimate pursuer. The biblical reader, well, I'll speak for myself, but I betcha many of you would agree with me here, that we don't have a whole lot of sympathy for Shaul in terms of, yes, Shaul should kill David. In fact, Shaul is viewed as losing it mentally. And David is the poor, innocent victim who's as loyal as they go, and yet Shaul is doing all these things that are illegitimate. And yet David restrains himself in a moment where he really had Shaul in his clutches. Pasuk Yud Aleph, Ve'avi, dad. Don't forget, there's three things that avi can mean here. One is, if you're in the younger generation, this is just how you respectfully address somebody in the older generation. So there doesn't have to be anything exciting about that. Avi also can be a sign of love. It's like, look, dad. It could certainly have a much warmer feel than just, hey, old man. And the third element is he actually is his father-in-law. So it's actually appropriate just in terms of the family tree at the moment. He's already married Michal by this point in the story. So actually he can call him dad in terms of how a son-in-law could refer to his own father-in-law. Ya'vi re'e gam re'e knaf mi'elcha bi'adi ki b'chorti et knaf mi'elcha l'arakticha da'or e ki en bi'adi ra'au b'pesha b'lochatati lachva ta'tzadet nafshi l'kapta. Look, Shaul, you should realize that I could have killed you and didn't, and that proves that I don't want to kill you. So stop deluding yourself into thinking that I'm a traitor. In fact, I'm your most loyal citizen. Now here you see another side of David's emotions coming up right over here. Yishpat Hashem beinu beinecha. May God judge between us. That's not the, dad, don't you see? This is David saying, God should really strike you dead, Shaul. I'm not going to be the one to do it. Yishpot Hashem beinu beinecha, unkamani Hashem mimecha. May God avenge me against you. Bi'adi lo tiyabach. But I'm not going to be the one to do it. So here you see, it's not that David is saying, oh, don't worry, Shaul, all is forgiven. Forget about it. David wants Shaul dead, and not only does he want Shaul dead, but he tells Shaul that he wants Shaul dead. He just doesn't want to be the one to do it. He does not wish for him or his merry men to kill Shaul because he's Mashiach Hashem. He's God's anointed. Now, on one level, this is and the dialogue goes on with David oscillating between these two tones. One of total submission and humility and some kind of love, perhaps. The term ahava is certainly not used here. But at the very least, some warm emotional sense. And part of him is very harsh and says, God should strike you dead, Shaul. What you're doing is so illegitimate. The sooner the better. But until God does that, none of us are going to harm you because we are your loyal citizens. Now, what's motivating David? There's no question that a good deal of this is piety. He sees Shaul as God's anointed. I believe him. God, in fact, has chosen Shaul to be the first king. And puzzlingly, even though Shaul has been rejected, it would make life easier for everybody had Shaul just choked on a chicken bone the next day and you don't have this whole conflict that runs on for the duration of Sefer, what we call Shmuel Aleph. Right? That would have made life a lot smoother for everybody. Instead, Shaul is alive as a lame duck king and knows he's lame duck. David is in this bizarro situation where he's anointed, knows he's going to be king, but has no clue how or when. And typically in the ancient Near East or in any society, the right thing to do is assassinate the prior king. But David refuses to do that, even though it's legitimate in this case. Okay, so that's where we're at. That's the primary reason why David is motivated not to kill Shaul. Ralbag says, wait a minute, there's another reason too. Not to exclude the piety part, that's definitely here, but there's got to be some other reason why David doesn't kill Shaul. And it goes like this. Let's see here. If David kills Shaul, it's legitimate, right? You're going to ride with me on this. Shaul is Israel's king ever, number one. And David knows he's going to be Israel's king number two. If David assassinates king number one, even if it's legitimate, that sets a precedent that if you don't like the current king, you kill him. And since David happens to know that he's going to be king number two, he really doesn't want anybody to have that precedent. And so very prudently, even at this very emotional moment, David is also a brilliant strategist. He's thinking, I can't harm Shaul, because if I do, that puts me and my dynasty in danger. What I need to do is wait this one out and emphasize, whoever's the current king, that's God's anointed. He wants to teach the nation and the armies that whoever's currently the king is God's anointed, and that not only does this protect Shaul out of piety, but it also protects David and his progeny from future assassinations. And Abarbanel accepts this also as this dual reason, dual motivation why David isn't killing Shaul. And that's what happens when you're dealing with public figures, even if they have an interpersonal relationship going on in Tanakh. Shaul and David have a personal relationship. Shaul loves David because of the music part. He hates David and wants to kill him because of the resentment over the monarchy. David seems to love Shaul, even though that's not clear, but you can't prove it anymore because David also just might be looking out for his own interest, which is not bad. There's nothing wrong with not wanting to be assassinated. This is not a criticism of David. But it's a very different kind of motivation from either piety or loyalty towards or love of Shaul. There does not need to be any love of Shaul for this passage to work. And there is simply no reference to actual love of Shaul by David. In fact, later on, there's somebody, you know, when this Nar HaMelech, he says, "Hey, David, I killed Shaul." He's thinking, "Oh man, I'm going to be vice king now." And David is like, "You're toast." Right? He hasn't killed right on the spot. "How dare you kill Mashiach Hashem?" And there are, you know, we already all know the pattern. There are Ralbag and Abarb and El saying again, David kills the Nar HaMelech in part because if you killed Shaul, that's horrible. You killed Mashiach Hashem, exactly taking David at his word. But it's also letting everybody know, don't mess with the king. I'm king now. Nobody's messing with the king. And the same thing happens when Ishbosheth, Shaul's sons, assassinate Ishbosheth and they bring the head to David, also expecting to garner favor with David. And instead, they garner their immediate death. And David does the same thing. He tells them once again, he lets everybody know, you mess with Mashiach Hashem, this is going to happen to you also. So Ralbag and Abarbanel argue throughout that David has a huge loyalty towards Shaul. He has a huge loyalty towards Shaul because he is God's chosen, but he also is protecting his own neck from future potential of assassination. And that is the ambiguity in David's relationship towards Shaul. I can never tell you, did he love Shaul? Maybe, he might have loved him a lot. But he also might not have loved him one drop. He even might have hated him, even though I said I wasn't going to talk about hate today, but he might have. And it might have even been legitimate to hate him, because after all, Shaul is throwing spears at him and taking half the army and chasing him and his merry men illegitimately around the country. So that's the Shaul-David part of the story. Now we move on to Yonatan and David. Now Yonatan and David's love is canonized by Pirkei Avot as the ultimate pure love. And it's hard not to love this relationship, and it's hard not to love Yonatan. He's amazing. I can't get over how gracious he is. One curiosity which Sefer Shmuel doesn't deal with, I'm just going to toss it on out there because that's what you do in Shiurim when you have the floor. You toss on these things, and if any of you have a good answer to this one, let me know. You know, the whole thing about David and Goliath in the story of David killing the giant is that Shaul obviously was the one who was supposed to go. That's what Goliath was challenging him. He says, "Come on, I want a one-on-one combat here. And I'm tall, and Shaul is really tall, and he's the king after all. Let's go, one hero against another, winner takes all." And so Shaul, rightly, is terrified out of his wits. And so David, we all know the story, grabs his little slingshot, a couple of nice rocks, zaps him, bam, giant is dead, David becomes a national hero. What's interesting to me, well that's interesting too, what's interesting also is that Yonatan was there. And he's absent from that whole thing. You forget, hey, if Shaul's not going to go, what happens to heroic Yonatan, who already has established himself as an incredible, faithful hero? The answer is, I don't know. I'm not criticizing him either. I wouldn't want to go against Goliath either. For the record, just even though David's faith should not be diminished at all from his heroic charge against the giant, Radak in the medieval period and Moshe Dayan, the Israeli general, he thought it was his original idea, speaking as a general, but Radak, who was just a medieval rabbi, thought the same thing as well. David actually didn't just have great faith. He outwitted the giant by changing the rules of the game. Goliath was expecting a close sword combat. And he was armed to the teeth, and he figured whoever gets within sword range is doomed. Who's going to beat Goliath? David grabs a slingshot. That was his brilliance, right? He takes, you know, projectiles. If he missed, Goliath can't even move to get him. And David can take another shot. And David can take another shot, and if he keeps on missing, okay, he's the wrong guy, but he can just go back to the camp. And that's what enabled him to win. It was not just a great amount of emunah, but it was incredible military brilliance. He changed the rules of the game, and that's what enabled B'nai Israel to win. Shaul was expecting to actually go hand-to-hand combat with Goliath, that was the terms of the deal. And of course, that was a bad idea, which is why he did not go. Okay, so that's a side point, but relevant. Yonatan is blown away. He's there. He didn't do anything about it. I don't know why, but when he sees David going out there, he realizes, you know what? David is a better man than I. And that is one of the most gracious things a prince can say or think. It's incredible that Yonatan sees David going out there and he realizes, if he wins, he should be king. As much as I'm the crown prince, as far as he knows, he's wrong, because we know as the readers that Shmuel and God have already rejected Shaul and his monarchy. But Yonatan doesn't know that yet. So Yonatan is expecting to be the king. But when he sees David go out there, he says, kingship is yours. And in an incredible statement in source number 3, right after the Goliath episode, el Shaul, b'nefesh Yonatan nikshira b'nefesh David, avehu Yonatan kinafsho. He loved him like his own soul. That is beautiful. Whatever, however you wish to translate the ahava here, it's pretty good. By the way, Shaul realized also that he had a great military hero in his midst, so he brought him in. No longer is David going to be a family shepherd. Because he loved him like his own soul. Notice once again, it's one way. We don't know how David feels towards Yonatan in this story, right? Yonatan, by transferring these garments, is symbolically saying, you are to be king. And David understands that all too well. And so we have this powerful one-way love from Yonatan towards David, and we just don't know how David feels towards Yonatan at all. And this carries over to other dialogues where Yonatan goes out of his way to protect David's life. He realizes that Shaul is going down the tubes. He realizes that Shaul wants to kill David. And Yonatan personally sides with David against his own father. Source 4. Vayaged Yonatan leDavid lemor, mevakesh Shaul avi lamitecha. Yonatan finds out that his father is scheming to kill David, so he tells David, he gives David the heads up, you better go hide. I'll be your guy. I'll talk to Shaul, feel him out, and then I'll come and report to you unbeknownst to him. Yonatan takes it personally to protect David. And likewise in source number 5, Ayivrach David minayop ramah vayavov vayomer lifnei Yonatan. Me'asiti me'avoni me'achatati lifnei avicha kima me'achesh nafshi. Why does your father want to kill me? I've done nothing wrong. Vayomer lo chalila lo tamut. Hine lo yaseh avi davar gadol davar katon v'lo yigleh tozni. Madu yaseh avi mimeni et hadavar hazeh ein zot. Don't worry. My father trusts me. He'll tell me anything. Now we, the reader, know that that's actually not true. Yonatan thinks that Shaul reveals all to Yonatan. So he's like, I haven't heard anything, and if I haven't heard anything, that means that my father's not plotting to kill you. But the whole point of the narrative is, he is. Right? So Yonatan at this point doesn't realize that Shaul has figured out, maybe don't confide in my son, because maybe my son has turned against me and is supporting David. Pasuk Gimel. Vayishava o David vayomer, yado yada avicha ki matzati chen beinecha. David is very suspicious. He says, Yonatan, I know you think that your father confides in you, but I don't think so. I think he knows that we're friends. And if he knows that we're friends, he's not going to trust you, and he may try to kill me anyway. And David's suspicions turn out to be correct. For the record, these are David's first words in the text to Yonatan at all. And he could have said this to anybody. There's nothing personal, there's nothing loving, it's just a very basic, you know, David rightly is nervous, and so he shares that nervousness with Yonatan, but there's no sense at all of mutual love between the two of them. Well, at this point, Yonatan and David both learn, Shaul is really mean, he means business. And so at the end, Yonatan tells David, you gotta go run away because Shaul is really coming after you, and they give each other a nice hug in source number 6. Anar Baba David Kame Ezel HaNegev, he comes out of hiding. Vayipol le'apav arza, vayishtachu shalosh pe'amim, vayishaku ish et re'eo, vayipku ish et re'eo, ad David higdil. They hug each other and they cry. So you could argue, well, they love each other, right? But why, you know, David has a good reason to cry. Namely, he now knows with certainty, Shaul wants to kill me and now I need to run away and become a refugee. There's no clarity as to what exactly the emotions are, and the narrator keeps it absolutely vague. We know that it's a very emotional, touching scene here, we appreciate, I'm sure David appreciates Yonatan's looking out for him, but there's simply no way to know, is there any love for David towards Yonatan? The text tells us time and again that Yonatan loves David, but there's no clarity to whether David loves Yonatan. The best example we have of David's love towards Yonatan is after Yonatan dies, he's killed in battle, and David gives that beautiful eulogy in source number 7. Tsar li alecha achi Yonatan, na'amta li me'od, nifleata batcha li me'avat nashim. I love you more, or your love towards me is even greater than the love of women. It's not at all clear. Notice how he's saying that your love towards me was greater than the love of women. It doesn't say, for example, you know, my love towards you. It's still, even in this late stage in the game, meaning Yonatan is dead, all the same, David seems to be expressing and missing Yonatan's love for him, but we don't know exactly how David feels towards Yonatan. I have no doubt that he appreciated all Yonatan did for him. Maybe he really loved him. We just don't know. And that means that with all these fraught emotional scenes that are going on, it's very unclear how David feels towards these very important protagonists who are also, from time to time, his family members, or at least very close to him. And this brings us to the Mishnah that I alluded to before, in source number 8. Kol avashi tliyaba davar batel davar batela ava. Whenever you have love that's contingent on something, well then, as soon as that something is gone, suddenly the love falls apart. That's not true love. What's true love? If it's not contingent on anything, that's going to last forever. Referring to the terrible rape scene in Perek Yud Gimel of Shmuel Bet, where Amnon lusted, David's son lusted after Tamar, who's David's daughter from a different wife, raped her, and after that, he suddenly hated her. Why? Because the whole love was rooted in this lust, and as soon as he had his way, suddenly that all vanished and the love vanished, and instead it became hatred for all kinds of reasons that we'll talk about if we ever give a shiur on hate in Sefer Shmuel. But for the time being, we're focusing on the love part, so here we go. The best type of love is this pure love between David and Yonatan. Now, Rabbeinu Yonah, one of the classical commentators on Pirkei Avot, lived in 13th century Girona. Rabbeinu Yonah argues, well, Yonatan's love for David is as good as it can possibly be, because Yonatan realized that by loving David, he was giving up his own throne. He stood to lose everything by his love towards David, and the fact that he persisted in this love really demonstrates this incredible layer of love. And that's a very powerful statement made by Rabbeinu Yonah, but if you're riding with the program here, well, that explains Yonatan's love for David. But it doesn't explain David's love for Yonatan, right? In other words, even Rabbeinu Yonah's comment on the Mishnah seems to speak in mutual terms. The love of David and Yonatan sounds like it's a two-way thing. But Rabbeinu Yonah's comment actually is quite in sync with the biblical text, right? He's saying that Yonatan had every reason to hate David or resent him or to try to kill him himself, because he was competition, and he was the most gracious man in the history of the world. That is pure love. That he loves him, protects him, risks his own life, even though he stands to lose everything. So this doesn't explain David's love of Yonatan, but that actually works in terms of our analysis of the text, in that there is no indication or no clear indication that David loves Yonatan. Again, I'm not trying to say that he doesn't. There's just no expression of that in the text. And I just want to add one other layer, though. Even though Rabbeinu Yonah is right that Yonatan must go down as one of the most gracious people in the history of the world, Yonatan also stood to gain a lot from this relationship. Don't think that he was a pure giver and gained nothing. And Yonatan knew this. Nothing that I'm going to say, by the way, is negative about Yonatan any more than what I said before is negative towards David. What I'm interested in is just trying to work out the different facets of Sefer Shmuel, what each one stands to get out of this relationship. Yonatan, first of all, thought, he makes this assumption on his own, David never offered it to him, in their last encounter in the text, in source number 9, Vayomer elav al tira, Yonatan tells David one last time, don't be afraid, ki lo tinzacha yad Shaul avi ve'ata timlocha Yisrael, you will be king, don't worry, Shaul will never capture you, you'll be king, and I will be your vice king. Now, there's nothing wrong with Yonatan wanting to be second in command. He has every right to it, honestly. He was the crown prince. He's abdicating the throne to the man he considers better than he is, namely David. But he still expects to be in power. It's not that he doesn't expect to be part of the picture anymore. Chazal debate the purity of motive in Yonatan's last statement in source number 10, in Bava Metzia. Damar Rabbi. Shlosha anfantanim hen. There are three humble people, and here they are. And one of them is Yonatan ben Shaul. Dekamar leila David v'atatim locha Yisrael v'ani ayelecha lemishneh. The first opinion argues, this shows Yonatan's incredible humility, that the crown prince officially and formally says, David, you're my superior, you have the right to the throne, I will just be your second in command. But then the challenging opinion here says, Mimai, how do you know that this is humble? Dilma Yonatan ben Shaul de Chazad Garir Alma Batar David. Maybe Yonatan was simply reading the writing on the wall. He couldn't help but notice that everybody in the country was crazy about David. It wasn't just Yonatan here. When David killed Goliath, that was it. What happened? Yonatan did what we already saw. Michal's eyelashes are all aflutter, right? The men of the country, the army, immediately swears loyalty to David, and the women come out there singing the best praises that any man has ever gotten, right? Within, you know, you kill one giant, you're entitled to all of this. There's no question that he becomes an instant national hero because he did what nobody else in the country could do, and he immediately garners love from every single sector of the population. So the second opinion in the Gemara challenges, when Yonatan says, I'm going to be your second, is that really humility? Or is it that he didn't have a choice? It's that he realized full well that if he tried to take the throne at this point, even though he's the king's son, the nation will say, we don't want you, we want David. David killed Goliath, you didn't. So there's a debate within Chazal here whether Yonatan's motive should be viewed as purely gracious, as Rabbeinu Yonah understands them, or whether he understood that he should be gaining something for this as well. He was simply being prudent. Another important thing that Yonatan knew that he was going to gain from this relationship is, granting that David is going to be king. Well, you know what ancient Near Eastern kings do to families of the previous king? Not good things, right? Ancient Near Eastern kings, if there's a usurper, in this case David would be the usurper, and he takes the throne, the greatest hazards to David, from a political standpoint, are anybody in Shaul's family. Because they'll say, hey, who's this guy? How come he has the throne? We are the family of Shaul. And so very often what an ancient Near Eastern monarch would do upon usurping the throne is you exterminate the family of the predecessor. That's what you do. It's horrible. But lots of things about ancient Near Eastern monarchy are horrible. And this is one of them. With all of the love that's going on between Yonatan and David, and it seems so pure and great friendship over here, Yonatan never ceases to remind David, by the way, David, please never swear to me that you'll never wipe out my family. Which is a strange thing for best friends to be saying to one another, but the reason why he keeps making David swear this is presumably because he is concerned that David might do it. Right? So for example, source number 11, exactly as Yonatan is busy saving David's life, please never stop being loyal to my family. He loved him as his, like his soul. So it's an interesting juxtaposition here. Part of him is being as prudent goes. He's trying to protect his family members. And part of him is loving David as his own soul. So which one is it? Is he being practical? Is he being just the best friend that anybody's ever had? So Abarbanel and Malbim argue on these psukim, the fact that the text goes out of its way to say that he loves him like his soul means that even though he's looking out for his own descendants, he also really loves David. It shows the magnitude of the, at least unilateral love, that Yonatan has towards David. But there's no question that Yonatan stood to gain two things from this relationship. One is that he wished to be second in command, and the other one, more importantly, is that he wished for David never to harm any of his descendants. And by the way, Shmuel Bet goes out of its way to tell us David honored this treaty. Right, when David massacred other family members of Shaul for one reason or another, he did not harm the descendants of Yonatan. He protected Yonatan's children as part of this treaty that Yonatan made. So the treaty worked. But that shows that there's a different layer that's going on. It's not just two best friends that we should all aspire to in our friendships. There's no question that there is a strong political, it's not just undertone, it's there. It's in the text itself. And the reason why it's there is because we're dealing with succession in dynasty here. And Yonatan and David, as much as they might have been personal friends who enjoyed playing frisbee, the fact of the matter is that there were a lot of political concerns for David. Yonatan granted David legitimacy. If Yonatan himself gives up his throne, that's very legitimate indeed. And Yonatan gains the protection, or the hopeful protection, of this treaty that David, even if he takes the throne, will not in fact exterminate Yonatan's families. So in this regard, again, I don't know that David didn't love Yonatan a lot. He probably did. But there's simply no way to know because the text keeps things incredibly opaque. David's emotions do not shine through in the text, whereas Yonatan's emotions do. And even Yonatan's emotions, which rightly are in the text, we don't have a clear sense that it was as pure as Rabbeinu Yonah made it, but rather there was a prudent component, which is certainly not negative. It's good to be prudent. But that's different from just talking about this nice abstract best friendship of private people who actually could have such a pure friendship, or at least something very close to it. And this brings us to Michal. If you want to keep track of statistics of women loving their men in Tanakh, you should know that this is the only time that it is mentioned. Right? When it says, you know, after David kills Goliath, so again, Yonatan immediately loves him as a soul and gives him his stuff, which indicates, I want you to be king. And as I mentioned before, Michal's eyelashes are all aflutter. Vatehav Michal, source number 12, Bat-Shaul et David, Vayagidu le-Shaul, Vayishar hadavar be'inav. Michal loves David. That's the only place in all of Tanakh that it says that a woman loved her man. They weren't quite married yet, but they will be. That doesn't mean that Sarah didn't love Abraham. It doesn't mean that Rivka didn't love Yitzchak, and so on and so forth. There's simply no mention of that in any other biblical text. This is the only place. So you could argue, whoa, she must have really been crazy about him. And maybe she was. To be fair, going back to Susan Ackerman's point from before, she is actually still the dominant party in this relationship. She is the princess, and David is still the outsider. And so it makes sense in light of all the other unilateral expressions of love in all of Tanakh, where the dominant party is always the one, always, where it says that he or she loves, it makes sense that since she is the dominant party in this relationship, she is the princess, that she would be the one about whom it says that she loves. But it's also parallel to the system of Michal's emotions come across in the text a lot, and David's emotions don't come across the text a lot in the text a lot. For example, when, I love this story, you know, where after Shaul is hurling spears and chasing David all over the, well, not all over the country yet. David right now is home with Michal, now his wife. And the soldiers go, bang, 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 open up in the name of the law. We've come to seize David. He's a traitor to the king. And Michal comes to the door. It's like, you know, sorry, he's sick. Can you come back tomorrow? And they're like, oh, sorry, ma'am. And they go, love that. Somebody should hire better bodyguards. In the meantime, by the way, I would argue if I had more time that in a nutshell, the primary reason why the guards were so utterly foolish sounding is actually they were not foolish at all. They didn't want to harm David. They're loyal to David because David killed the giant. The only one in the kingdom who wants to kill David is Shaul. So the guards do their job, but as soon as Michal tells them to go away, they're like, okay, we go away. And then next time, great catch the thief trick where they knock on the front door and David just climbs out the back window. You know, so again, either Shaul's soldiers really need to talk to somebody who has working brain cells, or more likely they actually intelligently wished to listen to Shaul. They obeyed him. They didn't want to come back as rebels, but they did everything they could not to capture David because David is beloved to them as much as he is beloved to us. But Michal has to make a big decision there, right? She risks her life when the soldiers come back. She doesn't reel in. She doesn't know that they're going to be so harmless. And she sides with David against Shaul, just as Yonatan does. Both of Shaul's children side with David against their own father. And that really demonstrates a very clear sense of loyalty for Michal towards David. But we don't know how David feels towards Shaul. Rav Amnon Bazak of Yeshivat Har Etzion published an interesting sefer a few years ago called Makbilot Nifkashot. I have it in for further study references. I recommend it. He argues from what I'm telling you here, it must be that David did not love Michal at all. It says repeatedly that Michal loves David. It says that she was loyal to him. She did stuff for him. As far as Rav Bazak is concerned, it doesn't say that David loves Michal because David did not love Michal. Why is he in this relationship? Because it gets him into the kingdom. even though Shmuel HaNavi has anointed him, David has no clue how that's going to work out in practice. So the right way to go here is kill a giant and become national hero, marry the princess, ta-da, now you're in line for succession, and now you're no longer an outsider. So from that vantage point, Rav Bazak argues that David's sole motivation in marrying Michal was to gain political legitimacy rather than for any emotional reciprocity towards Michal's love. But as I mentioned before, that may be true, but that also may not be true, because it never says that both characters love one another in any biblical narrative and throughout all of Tanakh, and therefore it could well be that David loves Michal, and it's just not going to be mentioned here. What is relevant, though, is that Michal, as the daughter of Shaul, certainly comes up in political contexts down the road, giving Rav Bazak some strength in his argument. In source number 13, right now the plan is for Ish-bosheth to stop being king and for David to finally reign over the united monarchy. So one thing that David wants here is Vayomer Tov Ani Echrot Yitcha Brit. Ach Davar Echad Anochi Shoel Meitcha. He tells Avner Ben Ner, the general of the now deceased Shaul, I want one thing. Lo Tire Panai. Bring me Michal back, my wife. But he doesn't say my wife. Right? He says Michal bat Shaul. Even though he could just say, look, let me have my wife back. There's been a big misunderstanding. I was married to her. But right over here, David is not thinking about, oh, my beloved who's now in hostile hands. No, he's thinking about, I need bat Shaul to be back in my home. Because Bat Shaul is what gives me legitimacy to the north. As soon as Michal returns, then Shevet Binyamin will cross the line and be able to say, okay, we're going to support you, David. Then when David speaks to Ishbosheth, where he sends messengers, Vayishlach David Malachim el Ishbosheth ben Shaul emor, Tonight Ishti et Michal asher irasti li b'me'ah or lo plishti, and give me my wife back. To Ishbosheth he says, give me my wife back because you owe me her. Here he doesn't want to talk about legitimacy. He just wants to tell Ishbosheth it's the right thing to do. We're married. I want to be with my wife. And so David very cleverly, it depends who he's talking to. When he's speaking to Avner, he gives away his true motivation, which is he needs Michal back because she's Bat Shaul, gives the legitimacy to throne. Whereas when he talks to Ishbosheth, he's using the more persuasive argument. If he starts talking about, give me your sister, that's no good. If he says, give me Michal Bat Shaul, then Ishbosheth understands, wait a minute, guess what David is trying to do here? He's trying to get my monarchy away from me. But if he says, give me back my wife, that's something that Ishbosheth will listen to. And that's ultimately what happens. David is a very shrewd and otherwise brilliant man. He really understood exactly how to speak to the individual players in these stories. And in this case, he uses all the right terminology. But this supports Rav Amnon Bazak's thesis that David is very keen on the Michal Bat Shaul part. And this comes out finally in the blow-up between them in Perek Vav. After David now has the united monarchy, and dances the Aron HaKodesh to Yerushalayim, which he has recently captured, we have the breakup scene between David and Michal. It's very sad. Source number 14. V'haya Aron Hashem ba'ir David, Umichal bat Shaul nishkifa be'arach halon. Vateret amelat David mifazez umcharker lifnei Hashem, vativez lo b'livav. Michal is furious at him. She sees him dancing around, practically naked. She considers this an incredible abuse and degradation of the monarchy, and she's going to let him have it, right? David comes home feeling all good about himself and religiously on this incredibly euphoric high. Vayashov David v'varecha be'tov atetze Michal bat Shaul. Likrat David, Vatomer, Manich Bara Yom Melech Israel. Oh, King, how honorable are you? Sarcasm in, without needing italics is just great. Tanakh has a great knack for being able to do that. Hashem Nigla Yom Leinam Hotav Adav Kikalot Niglod Achad Harekim. You're exposing yourself the way the lowest members of society would do this. This is disgusting. And you call yourself the king? Ugh. Vayomer David al Michal, Lifnei Hashem, Asher Bachar Bi Me'avicha. Ouch. Right? And it was the Bat Shaul part that was coming across loud and clear to us. David zaps her with it, right? In other words, now it's Michal Bat Shaul, it's not Michal Eshet David anymore. So you already see the distance where Michal stands up for her own family values, and David says, you're part of the Shaul camp. God has chosen me over your father. Michal Beito, from all of his family, which includes, Yonatan and you and others. L'savorot inagid alam Hashem al Yisrael v'sichati l'fnei Hashem. Nikaloti od mizot vayiti shafal beinai imam mahot asher amarti imam ikabeda. I'm going to dance however I want because I'm honoring God here. U'michal bat Shaul lo haya la yeled ad yom mota. Now poor Michal does not have any children, and it's Michal bat Shaul again. So in this story, we have a very clear sense that there's a distance between David and Michal. They're almost not married. Michal becomes the princess of Shaul, who's part of the rejected family line. And David here is rejecting Michal. This is the end of that relationship, or at least the end of the child-bearing part of the relationship, which is very disturbing. Rav Amnon Bazak argues that the surface level of the hostility here is that Michal criticizes David. David says, hey, I was being religious here. I wasn't doing this to degrade anybody. Right? And that's one element of the story. But Rav Bazak argues that Michal here is just heartbroken because she really loved David all along. And you'll notice here she's looking through a window. In Perek Yotet, when she saved David's life, how did she save David? She lowered him out the window. So Michal gave her life and soul. She sided with David against Shaul. She really loved him. And what she senses here is that, you know, she's looking through the window and it's empty. She feels so lonely at this moment. David never loved her at all. David always looked to her as the source of legitimacy to the throne, and now essentially doesn't need her anymore because he's king. All of a sudden, the politics of this love relationship are gone. David has unanimous support of the people, and as a result, Michal has lost out, and this breaks down the marriage right over here, which of course is going to open the door, another ballgame already, to Bathsheba, because now David needs a new wife who's going to produce the heir to the throne. And that's going to open up a different can of worms for a different time. But for our purposes, there does seem to be a very clear, strong political motivation that David has towards marrying Michal in the first place, and that ends as soon as David has united reign over the people, where suddenly she becomes Bat Shaul. There's no longer any need for Michal in his life. The summary of all of this is that how does love work in Sefer Shmuel with the most passionate man in Tanakh, David, or at least one of the most passionate? The answer is we really never know how David feels towards any of these characters, right? He might have really loved all of them. Possible. It's possible that he loved none of them and not at all, or somewhere in between. And I tried to walk through with you these different mikorot, these different passages that are in Tanakh to try to show that there are different elements of just how love works, right? And then there's an element of these are public figures, so there's the political dimension that you cannot ignore in these relationships. And then you just have the ambiguity that David's emotions are kept opaque by the narrator, it seems very deliberately. So we never really know if David is loving them but secretly, or if he's being politically shrewd, and he's always politically shrewd, but there's no reason to believe that there wasn't also an underlying dimension of love. And the reason why I like Sugiyot like this, and that's why I wanted to share it with you this morning, is because these characters are just so alive and they're so real. I can't get over the fact that a Navi some 3,000 years ago was able to write a story that is absolutely realistic, that is absolutely mesmerizing, that's dealing with some of Tanakh's great heroes at the time of the transition of a government and ultimately leading to David, who becomes Tanakh's most beloved figure. And it talks about them in a way that you and I in the 21st century can learn them and be completely gripped by them. And we can debate every single last one of these mikorot because each one brings with it such a great deal of complexity and ultimately life. So I focused on the love side of the day. Maybe your next year that you go to will be one about hate, so that way you get some balance. But I appreciate your coming. Thank you so much.
Why in course one, if in three out of the four instances, clearly the first person is David?
There's an article written about that challenging the common meaning that Shaul loves David by saying that David is the subject of the other verbs, and maybe he's the subject.